Please help me give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Mike H. from the United We Stand Home Group.
I really don't need this up here because I got a loud voice anyway, y'all. Okay, I'm going to give y'all a little quick bio on me. I want to start my little thing here so I don't keep y'all overnight. Let me hit 45 minutes here. Okay, here we go. I was born and raised in Norfolk. Basically, middle class, dad worked, put clothes on her back. Mom was a stay-at-home mom. Have older sister, older brother, and of course that makes me the baby, I'm the best. But my father was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic on both sides. They were violent, but my father, I put him in the category as a sleeper. He got his snoot, came in, went to sleep. Okay. At a very, very young age, I would probably say between 8 and 9, I looked up to my dad as a superman. He could do no wrong. And this is how alcohol got into my life, looking up to my dad. I would see him in the garage. I would sneak and see through the window. He'd go to the file cabinet, pull the bottle out, drink the water, okay? Well, lo and behold, curiosity gets a hold of Michael. Michael goes out there, does what daddy does. Was not water. I remember the burning, the numbing, and that brick hitting the bottom of my stomach. And I knew right then and there, I was in love. I wanted it, I was in love. That proceeded to go on all through elementary school. All my friends in the neighborhood, their daddies drank, had the wet bars, so we got what we wanted. Drank, went to school. I did that numerous times until, the teachers caught on and the principals and, sending us home. And got my butt whipped a few times. But, that didn't change nothing. Then as I got older, the first year junior high school, 7th grade, that was it. Game on. Didn't even really go to school that much because we were always going to somebody's house, getting drunk, getting high. And what really got in trouble was just so happened one day, it was about 35, 40 of us decided to skip school. And the truant officer figured that out. So we all decided to go and get their own stash. And we went back and got underneath the railroad track, underneath the trestles. Lo and behold, somebody has to take a leak. Well, this one kid gets up and looks up down the railroad track and hears two police officers walking down this way. And he turns and looks the other way. And there's two police cars at the street. They're coming. So guess what? We scattered like rats and mice. The only place to go was in the creek. So we did that, jumping over people's fences and doing damage to things. They caught us, took us down to juvenile hall. That time, my mom was working, and of course, getting called away from work, that pissed her off. So my granddaddy had to get her. Came down, got us. When she got there, we were asked very politely, Michael was not allowed to attend public school anymore. Well, at the time, We got home, Dad got home, Mom and Dad started talking. Dad got pissed, sent him to military school. Mom didn't want that. So Mom says, let's try Christian school. So guess what? Mike goes to a Christian school. 3 months in at this Christian school, they have this function called a rock-a-thon. You sit in a rocking chair. You rock 50 minutes and you have a 10-minute break. Well, there was these two brothers that had an older brother, hooked them up with a half a gallon. So every 50 minutes we'd go and we went into the sanctuary. And here's two guys and me drinking in the sanctuary. We go back in, rock a little bit, and these nuns and sisters walking around, you can tell, and they're smelling, you know, and we're looking at each other, getting paranoid. We go back in one more time to drink some more. Lights come flying on. There's the minister, the preacher there, and, you know, the rest of that one. We were gone the next morning. Well, right down the street was another Christian school, and I told my mom and dad, I don't want to go to school. I don't need school. You're going to school, boy, as my dad said. So drove down there, pulled into the parking lot. Here's this big preacher man standing out on the front porch, like a warden, just standing there. I get out and I have my attitude. I walk up to him, I said, you ain't gonna keep me here. You're gonna kick me out, I guarantee you. He goes, no, you ain't gonna get kicked out. We'll see. I'd say probably say about 6 months, almost at the end of the year. I got to know the routine when the teachers would go on a break. Me and another guy took a rope, went upstairs, tied a rope across the top of the stairs. We're sitting around looking. Teacher comes out, trips, falls down the stairs, breaks a collarbone, 2 ribs. We didn't have to say we did it. They know who did it. Preacher man comes, does the little finger, come on out. So we go into the office, set right in front of him. I said, I told you you were going to kick me out. He says, no, I ain't going to kick you out. Right then and there, I said, what do I have to do? Do I have to kill somebody to get out of here? Well, needless to say, I didn't get kicked out. Unfortunately, there was a nun, God love her, took me under her freaking wing for 3 years. 3 years. Every day after freaking school, I drove home with her and she tutored me for 3 years until she saw me in my cap and gown. During graduation, she did not tell me until that night. Her and her husband went on a cruise, on an anniversary cruise. She told me her and her husband could not enjoy the cruise because they were worried about what I was doing to the teachers and other people at the school. And back then we didn't have cell phones, so she used the ship phone. Cost a lot of money. But, anyway, I did graduate. Then I just talked to my dad, and I said, you know, I want to trade. I want to know how to do something. Once you got a trade, nobody can take it away from you. So he says, I'll get you in the shipyard. Great, Dad, I can do that. So I went to trade school, got out. That was in 89, and I got at Metro Machine Shipyard. First day was January 4th, 1990. Cold as blue blazes. And I had to go work in the dry dock. Well, this old timer came up and says, hey, come here, boy. You want to stay warm? I got something to put in your coffee. Guess what? First day on the job, he's lighting me up with the alcohol. I said, I've got a nice job now. That lasted a good long time. Lasted about 9 years. Traveled all over. I'm not going to bore y'all with that. When I lost that job, it was due to drinking. And during that time, when I was in the shipyard, I came across the lady that worked in the shipyard in the front end. We got married. All right. Got a good paying job, now I'm married. We got a house. She's got her kids, you know, cars, boat, motorcycle, all that. Life's good. But Michael wasn't happy. Michael wanted more. Michael wanted to drink more. I was not a physical person. I was the kind, once I got drunk, I disappeared. So my wife would not know where I was at for days. I'd leave on a Friday and not come home till Monday. That went on quite a while until she had enough of it. During the time at the shipyard, making all this good money, I go to a couple of bars and I ran into a group of guys. And just so happened when I was outside, when I walked in, the guy says, whose bike is that out there? And I said, it's mine. And I was commenced to drink and got to know each other pretty good, and that was the local hangout. So I said, yeah, I'll start hanging out in here. Well, after about 6 months, they said, hey, you want to ride with us? I was like, sure, man, what do I got to do? Nothing, you can just be a prospect, you know, you be a nice guy, you do what we tell you. I had all the drinks I want, all the women I wanted. Sound good. Well, lo and behold, one night, I had some stuff in one saddlebag and had some other stuff in another saddlebag. Going down Ocean View Boulevard, those in Norfolk know exactly what that road is back in the day. Lights come on, get pulled over. Comes up, opens the bags, and he hit pay dirt. So, handcuffed, took me down, went before the magistrate. First thing the magistrate said, he said, you're going away for a long time, boy. You're facing federal, not city, not local, you're doing federal. I didn't care. I didn't know the difference, you know. So that commenced me to start doing a little bit of time. While I was in the city doing my appeals and all that kind of stuff, I was there about a year. Then they transferred me out to a place called Southampton County. And I was out there for another 3.5 years. And they wanted me to do a plea deal. And I looked at them and I said, man, if I open my mouth, I'm littered in dog poop. No? So I had a good lawyer and a lot of technicalities. And just by the grace of God, I got out being an ideal inmate. So once I got out, I thought my life was going to be good. Wrong. Mm-hmm. Had to find a place, had to get juiced up again. Well, I did that for a long time. That was in the, you know, 2006 on. I was hitting the clubs, you know, Monday through Friday, and twice on Saturday and Sunday. it escalated to the point, my tolerance, I could not drink enough to get past a certain buzz. I just couldn't do it. And I could not drink enough to pass out. There was times, I'm sure you all had issues when you pee, it wasn't yellow, it was blood. And you know, I knew I was doing damage and everything. So did I stop? No. You know, controlled drinking, yeah. Did that for a long time, long, long time. Then in 99, my dad died. But unfortunately, when my dad died in 1999, he had 27 years sobriety. Bad thing was, when he started his sobriety, Michael was already drunk all the time. So I never saw my dad sober, and he never saw me sober. That was a hard amends to make, you know, later down the road. So it went on for a long, long time. All the jobs I had, I always looked for a job that I knew I could drink at. I knew I could drink at. And I did, many, many jobs. I will fast forward through a lot of jobs I lost. What brought me into these rooms was I had a job at a company that picks up your blue cans, recycling company. I was a metal fabricator. So I built dumpsters and compactors and stuff. In this building, it was humongous. And there was only three people. One guy at one end that messed with the blue trash cans. And then about 400 feet down the other end was me and another guy. And we both drank. My thing was, I had to wear a respirator, so I knew I could drink. And I had that job for 3.5 years. Every morning, Monday through Friday, 3.5 years, I never missed a day. Every morning, I had the same breakfast. I had a pint and a 12-pack when I got to work. Then I had an IV bag strapped to my leg, ran the hose up, and had my respirator on, and did work all day long. 3.5 years I did that. Well, one day, this boss comes and says, hey, I need you to drive a truck over to Hampton, to Aberdeen Road. I was like, I can't do that, Joe. Ain't no way. He goes, yeah, you can do it. You know, just egging me and egging me, and I'm getting more pissed off and pissed off. So finally, I said, give me the freaking keys. So what does Mike do? Get in the garbage truck. I go down Battlefield Boulevard, get on 64, heading towards Hampton. Get in the left lane, not far left-hand lane. I'm driving, pissed off. And all of a sudden, I get into the far left lane. I run this guy off the interstate down the embankment. Well, that scares the crap out of me. I go all the way across all the lanes of traffic on my side of the interstate, come back across, down the embankment, up the other side, on the other side of the interstate, incoming in a garbage truck. Never hit anybody, and nobody hit me. Well, I'm getting out, and all of a sudden, I see the state trooper coming up. It was a black female state trooper. She walks up to me, and my tolerance was so good. I was within, I know, at least 3 feet of her, talking to her, telling her what was going on. all the eyewitnesses, oh, he didn't see this person, you know, just random. Needless to say, I got away with an improper lane change ticket. I get in the truck, radio dispatch, been in an accident, blah, blah. Dispatcher says, you know what you're going to have to do? I said, yeah. She says, are you going to pass? I said, no. She goes, okay, we're sending a truck out. So anyway, get back to the shop, and you know what the answer was? You're out the gate. Lost that job. That was like on a Wednesday. I didn't tell my family or anything. Michael gets in the car, pretends like he's going to work, and get to the ABC store, get my bottle, sit in the car, drink all day. And I did that for 4 days. And I got tired of it because I finally said, this is it. This is it. I went. It was a Monday morning. Got in the car, went to the ABC store, got a bottle, put it in the front seat. And I had a big old 1999 Grand Marquis leather seat, right? So I said, you know, I'm gonna get on 64, put it on cruise control, let go, and that's it. But something said, hey, go by the church and see if the minister is there. So I go down Tidewater, go to the church, and as soon as I turn down the street, there's a McDonald's. The preacher was in the drive-thru at McDonald's. Well, I didn't see him, so I kept driving down, and when I pulled into the church, he wasn't there. And I was like, good, this is it. I'm done. The hell with it. I want to go kill myself now. Well, as soon as I was pulling out of the parking lot, here comes the preacher man barreling in. He says, Mike, what you doing? I said, what do you think I'm getting ready to do? He says, no, get out of the car. So I got out, and he talked me into, unfortunately, pouring that out. So he says, you know, you need to tell your family. And I was like ashamed, but I was afraid, fear, what's going to happen. He said, I'll be with you. I said, okay. So he called the house. Mom came up, went into the office, and I told her everything. And he says, well, you need some help? I said, yeah, I need help. Not knowing anything about AA. So I went home. Lord, I thought it was done with. Wrong again. Went to the store, got a bottle. Drank a few more days. And this was a heavy one. And I was in the garage. I went into the house, and my mom confronted me about my drinking. And the devil, or the alcohol, whatever you want to call it, flew into me. I grabbed my mom by her throat, and I took a knife off the counter, and I squeezed in her throat, and I took the knife up, and I kept yelling at her, I'm going to kill you, you B-word. I'm going to kill you, you B. And all she could do was scream to God. And that didn't put no fear into me. So I dropped the knife, ran out the house. I disappeared for a couple days. So once the fog got out of my brain, I called the house. My older brother answered the phone. I said, hey, Bubba, got a problem. Can I come home? He says, yeah, you got a problem. You need to get some help, boy. I said, okay. On the way home, I did stay sober. I didn't drink anything. So when I came home, I was walking up the driveway and heading to the back door. This is a small world, okay? Never ever knew the man that lived behind my mom and dad for 20-some years. He was in AA. And before I got to the back door, he was at the back fence and he yelled. He said, "Hey, MF-er, come here. Come over to the fence." I walked over and he says, "I heard what you did to your mom. You got an MF-ing problem. I want to help you." And he goes, "Be ready Wednesday night. I'm coming by and I'm going to pick your A up. And you're going to a meeting." I thought he was blowing smoke up my behind, okay? That Wednesday, it felt like a train was coming through the back door. He was banging on the back door. When I opened the back door, he was standing there with a baseball bat. He put the baseball bat on my forehead. He says, "Get your A in the truck now." Got in the truck, went to that meeting that Wednesday night. And I walked in and I started hearing some of y'all tell y'all story. And I'm like, man, I'm in the right place, man. But I was just there for one thing. Y'all tell me how I can control my drinking. I didn't want to quit. I did not want to quit. I love drinking, love getting drunk, love getting sick, everything. But then something, a light went off. I said, "My God, I tried to kill my mom because of this stupid liquid that changes me from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde syndrome," okay? Well, anyway, this guy in AA started talking to me and he would pick me up and take me to meetings. Well, I thought I had it under control. He says, "You need a sponsor. Go to all the meetings you can." It's like, I can do that. Well, guess what? I lasted maybe 30 days. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, he was the best sponsor you could have for a newbie. All he said was, "Get your big book, read it, call me if you have a question." I was like, yeah, this is easy. Well, I read it, I did the 12 steps, I'm cured. Well, there was a guy in my home group that when he heard that, he sort of came up and put a hole through my chest. He poked it and beat on my chest and he said, "You ain't done the S." He says, "You want to get sober? You want to stay sober. I can keep you sober, trust me, brother. Because if you go back out, I'm going to kick your ass." And this guy was about 6'5", 325. He was a professional bodyguard for all these celebrities, and he was a prison guard up in Boston on death row. He was on the extraction team. He was a big, big Puerto Rican boy. So he did put the fear in me. That lasted quite a while. Then my niece and her husband, he's a drinker, and they started having problems. And I was never ever there for my niece or my nephew. She came to me and said, "Uncle Michael, my husband's having a drinking problem." I said, "First of all, is it physical?" I said, "Don't tell me if it's physical. I don't want to know." So she goes, "No." I said, "Good." I said, "Let me talk to him." So that went on for a little while. And I asked him if he wanted to attend AA. He goes, "No, I got it under control. So what does this book say? You know, you got the three kind of drinkers, you know." I said, "Hey, which one do you think you are?" He put himself in the first one. Yeah, must be nice. So I helped him out for a while. And you know, here I am just starting AA, and this big Puerto Rican has taken me to conventions, to meetings, and of all the ones he took me to, he would take me to the candlelight meeting down on Collie Avenue. Because right across the street, they're sitting out there on the patio with the wine bottle and the drinks. And I looked at my sponsor and I said, I want to go over there and take that damn bottle and bust it over their head. He goes, no, you're not. Get in there. Shut up and sit down. I said, yes, sir. So I did it. I did what my sponsor said. A couple months later, we finished the 12 steps. And this kid walked in. It was his first night out of rehab. And I noticed my sponsor when I started talking to him. I didn't think nothing of it. Well, about 5 minutes later, my sponsor came over and said, you're going to sit beside him. If you need to hold his hand, you hold his hand. You don't let him leave until he has your phone number and you talk to him. I said, yes, sir. Didn't want to do that. I wasn't comfortable. I like being in my comfortable zone. But he was a hard nose. I needed that. I needed somebody to put a physically straighten me out. Thank God he did, and he's out of state now, but his sponsor, my granddaddy's sponsor, he picked me up for probably 3.5-4 years. And took me to meetings because my mom, my brother, and my sister didn't trust me that long in the program. They just still didn't trust me. And so finally, Alan couldn't make it. And I told my mom and my sister, I said, hey, you know, he can't make it. They said, do you think you can make it to the meeting and come back home? I said, yeah. I think something's going to happen. So I got in it, drove to the meeting, came home, all good. I said, hey, I got this. I can do it on my own now. Well, temptation, hitting right at 7-Eleven all the time. Ooh, that was hard going in there getting coffee instead of going to that cooler and opening that door. Because nobody was around. Nobody was there. Well, I got pretty good getting comfortable doing this program, okay? And I can always remember my sponsor telling me, don't you ever, it says in this book, that you cured, were never cured. And he told me that little scenario about the cucumber becoming a pickle, you know? What the freak is he talking about all these weird stories and stuff, you know? But those things, after a long period of time, you newcomers, one day at a time, easy does it, keep it simple, stupid. Just so many, but they work. We alcoholics try to reinvent the wheel. We're very complicated people. I mean, you know, 30 plus years of doing this insanity, and y'all know what insanity is, what it says in the book, and I change people, places, and things, and there's that big one, how, y'all know what that one is, but the hardest thing I have had to do in 8 years. And I'm coming up 8 years September, okay? And I want to tell you this, and I know y'all know what I want to say. Because it's one of the best 3 pages in the book in for my program. From 417 to 420, it's the word acceptance. And it says, accept Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me. I cannot find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing absolutely, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. That is my living proof right there. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. It took me a long time. The Serenity Prayer is short and sweet, but it is a very wide and vast saying. If you eat it, sleep it, pee it, poop it, you have a big chance. And what does it say, you old timers in here? The only thing we have is a daily reprieve. Is that not right? Just for today. We don't know what tomorrow brings. And I will leave. I know I like to cut things short, so if anybody wants to yell at me after the meeting. But please, I will say, what does it say? There's nothing more guaranteed that we will stay sober than to help another alcoholic. So when a newcomer comes in, jump on them with love. Jump on them with compassion. And don't let them feel like he's alone. Because if he does not feel love and the camaraderie that we have in these rooms, he's not going to come back. And what in the frig is out there? Turmoil, insanity, malady, and he'll probably end up, might have a chance to come back. But we're not guaranteed that, guys. I don't know what else to say except my life has been from black and white. And it says in here, bless you.
Thank you.
Even though you're in this program, it don't say nothing in here that life's going to be perfect every day. Some days life's hard, some days life sucks. And I will say I'm so glad this program says we practice spiritual progress, not perfection, because I would have failed long time ago, guys. So I appreciate y'all letting me run my mouth. I'm probably short, over, I don't know, 7 minutes, but other than that, I'm honored to come out here and let y'all know how this program has changed my life, and I live every day like it's my last, because I'm not guaranteed the bar. But I know when I leave here, I'm going to drive home. I'm going to talk to my higher power, cut the radio on, listen to some music, and I'm at peace because I'm sober. And I don't have to worry about no blue lights. Okay, thank y'all for being here, and let me yell at y'all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.